Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And good morning, Peter.
Good morning, sweetheart. And you're kicking the table.
You're giving me dirty looks.
Well, that's because you're kicking the table. And it's, listeners can probably hear you kicking the table.
Oh, okay.
She's not kicking my wooden headlessness. She's kicking the table, which is made of wood. And anyway, here we are.
Talking about food and wine and travel and all the good things
and
in
this
life.
This is Peter. You probably can figure that out for yourself. But we're doing something a little bit different today, because we're dealing with people writing about the act of producing food, of producing meals, of canning food, of barbecuing, all ladies barbecuing, curiously enough.
Yeah, but we've done this before. It's not like it's totally new.
Well, no, it's new from some time ago. So if listeners are relatively new to the program, they may not always realize that this is sometimes what we do. And sometimes what we do is unusual, in that we have a very unusual author called Deborah Madison, who took on the task of describing what it is that people like to eat, what they do about preparing meals and all that kind of stuff when they eat alone. An interesting subject, an interesting book, a very well put together book. I'm sure that you'll find this insight really quite fascinating.
Well, it's been a long time getting Deborah Madison on the program, and welcome, Deborah.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, and now, you must have had a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun reading your latest book, which is a little bit different from what you usually write, called What We Eat When We Eat Alone, which you worked on with your husband, Patrick McFarlane.
Yes.
And he, in fact, started this whole thing, right?
He did, and he didn't know he had started it. He didn't set out to do a book. We were traveling on these food think tank trips, and he didn't really know people. And partly to break the ice, I think, he started asking people this question and making notes. And I found the notes years later when we were moving, and I said, what are these? You know, this is so interesting. This is something we should do together. It might make an interesting book. And so eventually we did.
You know, you have sections that say, sort of imply or actually say that men and women have different approaches to cooking alone.
Seem to, yes.
Plays out in our house when I turn the microphone on. because exactly what you describe in the book is exactly what happens here. Now, I travel quite a lot, and Anne travels a lot less. But when I'm gone, she'll make chicken and make it last for 5 days, breakfast and lunch.
She can't
be bothered to make a meal, which is really funny because as far as turning out a meal is concerned, she's far and away the more accomplished of the two of us in doing that, and yet she doesn't. Now, when she's away, I make sure that I get something that I like, and I fix all the parts of it, and I make myself a real dinner. And I do exactly as you suggest in the book. I have a glass of my favorite wine as well.
Oh, well, good. Just the glass?
sometimes more than one. But I remember I used to visit my mother, who was a widow for the second time in 1982, and so she cooked alone for till she had to go into a nursing home. She cooked alone for 25 years.
But she mainly made desserts and fries.
Well, she made big pots of stews and things like that, and then she froze them in individual serving quantities. And
oh, that sounds very very. This is
playing out exactly as you describe it in the book, but you also tested various parts of the world, too, and there must be differences there, I think.
Oh, probably, but I can't say that this was a terribly scientific survey, We were mostly with food people who have a certain interest, at least in the beginning. But you brought up that you eat and a lot of leftovers.
Oh, yeah.
You make something, you eat off of it for days. And this is something that we found that people are very divided on, and not necessarily along the lines of male and female. But some people love leftovers.
And other people hate them, yeah.
And some people really just loathe them, in a very serious way. I was quite astonished.
Now, we know people who eat out every single day of the week, and quite happily, because they hate cooking and having leftovers.
Huh, to me, a leftover is a treasure.
Me too.
Yeah, this is what Anne likes. But we have a friend, and there is no socio-ethnic association involved. But when asked what she makes for dinner, she said she makes reservation.
Yeah, right.
So Norm Bloom and Linda Bloom, if you are listening, that's you. in case you didn't recognize yourself, but they've told us that all the time.
Well, one of the stories I loved most and surprised me most in the book was in the chapter called Alone at Last, which was particularly about people who are usually women cooking for kids and cooking for their families when they rarely get to be alone and finally they are what they do. Well, the last story in that chapter is not from a woman but from a man who happened to do the cooking in his household. And he reports how much he loved having this experience, and he used to always make lots of potatoes or lots of things to have leftovers, but he found that when he was cooking by himself, he would choose just three perfect potatoes to have for dinner with no leftovers. And that was, for him, it was kind of the spell of cooking for himself was almost like a revelation. He noticed sounds, he noticed smells and sights that he didn't normally notice when his wife was there and they were busy talking.
Now, the interesting, listeners, you mustn't think that this is just a psychological book in the behavior of mostly adults, male and female, and what they do when they're alone.
That's just one little part of it.
the key thing about it is the fascinating range of recipes. And did they come from real life, or did you make some of them up?
Oh, no, they all of these were really inspired by the people we interviewed. You know, we'd ask somebody what they liked, and they, like one woman, Aglaya Kremezi, who's a Greek cook, said, oh, I like to fry potatoes in olive oil, but I like some of them thick and some of them thin. She's very particular about that. You know, and then I make a sauce with yogurt and feta cheese and mustard. And I dip the potatoes in the sauce, and I have a glass of wine. And, well, we know Aglaya, and we knew this would be good, so I started to play with it, and then I'd email her and say, tell me more about this sauce. And she'd say, well, it has to be really ugly. Add enough mustard to make it ugly. Now, as a food writer, we're very invested in trying to seduce our readers, you know, to a recipe by its beauty. And but here, eating for herself, she's just going for the flavor, and it's not really a very pretty color, but boy, it sure tastes good.
Yeah, quite honestly, I fry potatoes, and usually they don't last until dinner's on the table.
Yeah, really?
He's a great potato fryer. Yeah.
It's true. I mean, people would say things, and then what they did, and then I'd say, oh, now that sounds like, with a little bit of work, you know, this could actually be made into a recipe. But then there were foods, a category of foods, that were so intensely personal that there's no way.
Yeah, tell us some
way.
Of those. They're funny.
They are funny. They're funny. They're weird. They're gusting. They're revolting. And
well, what is the thing with the, was it anchovy juice? What was it?
Oh, yeah, sardine juice poured over cottage cheese.
Yeah, that's what, that was really bad.
Yeah, there's some really bad ones in there, and so, of course, those are not foods that you would share with another person, so they didn't really lend themselves to being recipes.
Yeah, now, tell us, let us do first. I think we ought to mention the illustrations right away by your husband. Tell us a little bit about those and about your husband's background.
Oh, you know, he has a wicked sense of humor.
He sure
and,
does.
I mean, he paints in many different ways, and this isn't necessarily typical, but.
Yeah, he does fine arts, too.
He's a fine artist.
He's in
the. But he too, like me, he was very led by what people said. So, for example, one man we interviewed said, I always eat the old vegetables first.
Yeah, that was funny, wasn't it?
And so this image just came into his mind of putting a carrot in a walker, you know, and a pea on a stretcher.
Yeah.
The old and the infirm, you know, and so a lot of these, I think, have a great sense of humor.
Yeah, this lady standing in front of the empty refrigerator with her American Idol shirt, her underpants, and her bare feet. This is it.
But we've actually seen that played out.
I'm sure.
We were cooking for a fundraiser for somebody, and they had a great big double Sub-Zero refrigerator, and I opened it up, and there's nothing inside, just a little takeout carton of some old Chinese food or something.
Oh, dear. Is there anything that really totally surprised you, that some things the readers will find interesting, intriguing?
Well, I think what surprised me is how difficult it is for people to value their own company. And that so often the response to eating alone is, I'm not worth it. Or when my wife is gone, I don't even bother. Or I'd like to tell you that I braise a beautiful, you know, piece of meat for myself, but I only do that for somebody else. You know, there was so much of a kind of an attitude of almost dejection. that when somebody said, oh, eating alone, I love to eat alone, or it doesn't change what I do, or I open a bottle of wine and I do, you know, I make myself a dinner, like Peter was saying, when you hear that, it's so startling and so really refreshing, too, that it made me think about this whole business of eating and the degree to which it's social and the business of ourselves and how we value and respect ourselves or don't. It ends up being kind of a complicated issue.
Now, do you think that you and Patrick together have... No, this book, is a real contribution to what you would... What you just described, I guess, you'd probably call an issue or a problem, and now people can be equipped to cope.
Well, there's like alone every day, and you have a quote from Betty Fussell.
Oh, now that's such an inspiring quote.
Yeah, and we just interviewed her when she got the Lifetime Achievement Award at the Beards.
Uh-huh.
And she's inspiring. But her quote is, "I eat alone all the time in this my 79th year, and I love to eat alone. Nobody to please but myself."
Yes, and then she goes on to describe how she kind of hunts around the refrigerator and the back of the freezer, and she finds these little pieces, and she puts them together, and she makes this beautiful soup.
Yes.
It's a quote that made me think, this is why it's so good to know how to cook, because you can be resourceful. You find all these tidbits, and in your mind, you know how you can pull them together into something that you love and you enjoy. And that led me to think about kids, you know, young people.
Yes.
And how do they learn to cook? And how can they learn to provide for themselves and their friends?
Yeah, well, that was a nice attack you took there with the children's education part.
Now, I want to take issue with one thing that you wrote in the book.
Okay.
Because I think it's stereotyping. You said men are hunters and women are gatherers when it comes to shopping. Do you want to defend that position, or
I'm quite willing to back down, because as I said, this is not a very scientific survey, but it was a tendency. I mean, I've noticed this for a long, long, long time. Of course, there's going to be exceptions, and thank heavens there are. I suppose you're one of the exceptions.
He is. He does all the shopping.
Well, I think so. Now, what I don't do is I don't buy things I think I might need.
No.
I shop practically every day. Fortunately, the Whole Foods market is about 400 yards from our house. So I go, and if I need three things for dinner, I buy three things for dinner, and then I go back the next day. Now, I don't know whether that's gathering or hunting.
Well, I don't know. I think in the American landscape, that might be gathering, because your store is so close.
Well, anyway, here's the thing, listeners. This is a really cool book.
It is great time for it.
And it's a wonderful companion if you happen to be eating alone, because you can always seek inspiration as to what to do the next time you're alone while you're struggling over sardines or something. Early on, you seem to take on sardines as being a refuge of persons who cook, who eat alone and don't know how to cook.
So many people mention sardines. You know,
there's the club, the rise of the sardinistas. Did you read about that?
No, but I think these are canned.
It's a movement.
These are canned sardines in tomato sauce.
Right. Definitely canned sardines. But I mean, as we say in that chapter, you're rescued by sardines. You know, it's saved by sardines, rescued by pasta when all else fails. But what I did find is when people talked about what they actually cooked for themselves, there were wonderful things, some very complicated, some most very, very simple. And people who do cook for themselves want to do something. And in 15 or 20 minutes, it's amazing what you can do for one person. It's very different than cooking for a family of four or six. You can cook some artichokes. You can blanch some green beans. You can make a beautiful farmer's market salad. You can do all kinds of things. And it really is, it doesn't take so long to do.
Anyway, the book is called What We Eat When We Eat Alone.
And it has 100 recipes and stories.
And it has fabulous illustrations, and I wanted you to let us know whether you can actually buy prints separately as well if you're interested, and they really are absolutely delightful.
Yes,
amusing prints.
They're about to go up on my website.
And now, do you have a URL for that yet?
I'm DeborahMadison.com.
Okay.
And we are under construction, but hopefully up in the next...
And the Deborah is with an A-H on the end?
Yes, D-E-B-O-R-A-H.
Well, this has been a delight. I can tell you that it's been way too long, and I hope it won't be as long next time we interview you.
I hope so too.
Yeah, I can't wait for him to go off somewhere, so I can.
Well, maybe you can be alone together.
I'll come visit Deborah.
I guess it's not a whole lot different cooking for two, but the psychology is different.
It is very different.
And I think so much of what you write, I've taken issue with a couple of things, but so much of what you write is absolutely true to life. You relate to your own life experiences or other people's, and there are solutions here, at least when it comes to not being alone and the quality of the food on your plate and the wine in your glass. So thank you so much for joining us, Deborah. It was wonderful to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I enjoyed talking with you both.
Oh, great. Thanks, Deborah.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, it's now time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Don't forget to email us on the menu at onthemenuradio.com and do all those other ways that
you can be much more up to date in Kansas City now with Twitter and Facebook.
Just push a button and you can communicate to us.
And you can also get on our good old-fashioned blog, although our good old-fashioned blog has been taking second place to rebuilding the audio archive.
Right.
And I'm now back in 2005.
Oh, that's cool.
In fact, I put Heston Blumenthal and Alain Roux back up just a few days ago.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I'll get there, but I know listeners will appreciate it, so I feel happy doing it and just miserable that we had the problem that caused us to have to do that. But let's not cry in our beer because...
Are we moving on to what you do at this time of year?
We're moving on to canning and preserving, if that's what you mean.
Yes, you got to. It's already almost past due to make strawberry jam.
Is that right? So here's an indispensable resource, a wonderful lady called Karen Solomon who wrote a book called Jam It. Nice short title, Jam It, Pickle It. All kinds of stuff like that, so I'm sure you'll find this one really interesting.
I was saying to Karen Solomon, with her book, Jam It, Pickle It, Cure It, and Other Cooking Projects, she hits just about every trend that's hot right now, including do-it-yourself, crafting, artisanal, economic, just about everything. And I love this book, Karen.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Ann.
And she can talk, too. And she can talk. And you say on the cover, make your own bacon, cheese, marshmallows, and more. Could you just sort of give us a range for this book? I mean, of all the stuff that you're encouraging, you really want people to supply their pantry, don't you?
I do. I mean, and certainly not every day. That's just not, I mean, don't get me wrong, as much as I love to make my own everything, I do have a couple of bottles of salad dressing in my refrigerator door, just like everyone else. But the important thing that I really wanted people to realize is that we've had this wonderful revolution with sustainable fruits and vegetables, sustainable, organic, locally sourced produce, and wonderful, sustainable, grass-fed, fantastic, locally sourced meat. But all of the things in the center of the grocery store aisle, the crackers, cheese, pasta, the salad dressings, the ketchup, mustard, all of those things, you can also make those yourself from your own quality ingredients.
I never thought of making crack. I never crossed my mind that I should make crackers.
That's probably because you hardly ever eat crackers. that might have something to do with it.
I find Mary's got crackers. Crackers are just perfect.
They're pretty good crackers, but you can make your own, and they're delicious. It's more economical than buying the ones that come in a cardboard box. And then even from an environmental standpoint, you don't have to worry about the cardboard box or the food miles.
Yes, yeah, that's the other trend you hit, yeah. You hit that too.
That's something else to think about.
But what can possibly be wrong with a book that tells you how to make your own lard?
Yes, and your own lard is fantastic. If you start with really quality fat from a well-raised animal, it is delicious. I have to say, that is my most favorite fat in my kitchen right now, is my own homemade lard. And, of course, making your own meat. I mean, making your own bacon, making your own sausage, that is tough to rival with anything you can buy.
Yeah, see, I grew up with that. My mother made her own sausage, and she didn't even have an automatic machine. We stuffed it by hand into the casings.
Oh, my goodness. She had biceps, that woman.
Uh-huh, she did.
She had
5 feet tall.
She had determination.
Yes, and grit.
And olives. She wanted to cure her own olives, and I went out and bought olives, green olives. And then we looked up recipes, and every single recipe called for lye.
Well, how do you think you break the stuff down?
Well, no, she doesn't know.
Well, there's a different
Karen
recipe.
Doesn't use lye. Okay.
No, I mean, I'm certainly familiar with that method of using lye, but I have to tell you, we use lye in our house to clear a drain.
That
it's not effective for olives, but it scares me, frankly.
Oh, we didn't do it. We just threw out the olives, and we never did cure our own olives.
So what do you cure olives in?
Salt and water.
She just browns them.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. Now, lye is going to be quicker. Lye is going to get the bitter out of the fruit a lot faster than the salt and water method. But frankly, I'd just rather have salt and water in my food than lye.
Oh, sure. I mean, this is good to have another alternative to that, because I kept envisioning it clearing all my innards out. Burning them.
Well, here we go. Now, here's kimchi. Now, I bought a cabbage for tonight, so we're going to make instant kimchi for dinner?
Well, it's not going to be instant. You could definitely pickle some cabbage and have that ready to go, but really, my preference with the kimchi is to let it sit out and kind of ferment for about 3 days or so.
Okay, well, then we don't have quite enough time before dinner. We might be a little hungry before then.
That's right. You might be hungry before then, but there's definitely other quick pickles that you can make, too, like a Thai cucumber salad with a little red onion and salt and sugar, and that's really nice.
Yeah, your pickles just sound divine. Absolutely.
Oh, I love pickles. I love vinegar. I seriously will drink vinegar from my pantry, like just a good shot of balsamic vinegar. I absolutely.
Well, there is that stuff. What is that stuff we have, Abbott? Called royal sour or something?
Yeah, I mean, there is a vinegar liqueur kind of thing. I can't remember what it's called now.
Somebody gave it to us.
Comes in a very curious flat shaped bottle.
Yeah, it's a great bottle.
Noble sour.
Noble sour. Google
noble
that.
Sour. That's a new one on me.
Yeah, Google that and you'll see.
I will.
So, and what was the other thing I was going to say? I have to restrain Peter from hanging ducks all over our basement.
Hanging ducks?
Michael Ruhman was on the program talking about a book he wrote all about making prosciutto and salami
right.
Stuff like that. And he said duck breast was really easy to make.
That's interesting. I could do that.
And I could just hang it in the basement. But Anne said she thought that the ceiling level of our basement might be harboring all kinds of nasty things that would get involved in the process
well,
as well.
Well, that's true. I mean, how do you know?
So I had to give up on duck pastrami. It doesn't seem entirely fair, but I had to do that.
That is a cruel fate.
It is. It seems to me to be entirely unfair. If I can plant 24 tomato plants today, I certainly should be allowed to make duck pastrami.
You know, and I have to say, I am with you, and I love Mr. Ruhlman's books. I love charcuterie. That was a fantastic book. But I don't have a basement. I live in a city. I live in an apartment. I don't have the space or the cooler or anything like that to hang and cure my own meat like that. So for my book, I stuck to stuff that was pretty simple that could transpire.
Okay, so you made lard, and you made bacon, and you made sausage, but nothing more ambitious than that.
Well, I also cured gravlax, which is very easy to do.
Oh, okay, that's easy. And I'll let him do that. He can do that if he wants.
Now, that's in the section called hook it, right?
Right. Hook it, hunt it, noodle it, brine it. The way the book is led out, is the way that the book is laid out is sort of like to get you, to motivate you toward action. So action words. Jam it, pickle it, cure it.
I love that title, actually. Okay. Yeah, I also think that there's a certain fear factor. There are a lot of classes going on now to teach people how to can things that used to be second nature to all of us in our homes. But I just responded to a friend who's teaching canning 101 class that a really vivid memory from my childhood is all the tomatoes, the jarred canned tomatoes popping and breaking exploding on the shelves in the basement.
Oh my goodness, what a mess.
Yes, because of whatever, what is it, anaerobic bacteria that was in whatever.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And it's really amazing to me. I'm not exactly sure how this myth has perpetuated, but canning simple pickles and jams is really not difficult, and you don't need any special equipment. And I just can't encourage people to take this on enough. Like, today's canning is jars, self-sealing lids, and you don't really need anything more than a big, deep pot to get it going in your own kitchen. There's just a few basic rules that you have to remember, is that if you're going to do simple home canning, the food that you're making needs to be either high acid, so like a pickle with a lot of vinegar.
Yeah, but tomatoes are high.
Yeah, exactly. Tomatoes or anything that you've added, you know, vinegar to, anything that has a high pH, or jam, anything that has a high sugar content, or anything that's very salty. All those natural preservatives are going to keep your food from going off. And as long as your jars are clean, which, again, in the modern age, is very easy to do either in the dishwasher or in a sink full of hot water with just a tiny bit of bleach, as long as you start with sterile stuff.
So you don't have to sterilize them in boiling water the way my mother did?
Yeah, I mean, you definitely want it to be hot, soapy, slightly bleachy, or you could boil them in a pot of water.
Yeah, that's what she did.
Dishwasher. That's the easiest thing. Put them in, you run the cycle, and then when you're ready to can, you just take them out of the dishwasher, and they're ready to go. And I've never had a problem. I think things get trickier if you start doing foods that are not high acid, high sugar, or high salt. So let's say you want to can your own chicken soup, or you want to can your own tuna, something like that. You need a
sterilizer.
No, not a sterilizer. Oh, gosh, what's it called? I'm so glad you're editing.
Well, I will be. Not yet.
I'm so glad you will be editing.
Well, not to worry. I want to move on to how long things last, because that is another problem, I think, that I would make our salad dressing in a huge quantity, and we would just use it all the time. It never spoiled on me, but it was on my refrigerator all the time.
I find that the garlic goes, not off, but it definitely loses its bite in the fridge. So I tend to not make more. To be honest, most often when I make homemade salad dressing, I make it in the bottom of the bowl, and I make it for that salad. I will, on occasion, make a 3-day supply, a 4-day supply, but I tend to not go too far beyond that, particularly with something that's a vinaigrette style. I think the garlic seems to lose its bite in that style of dressing faster than, say, a creamy dressing.
Okay, so the quality is what suffers, not the, you know, it's not going to kill you.
No, definitely. I mean, certainly not. The only exception to that, I think, might be some people are very concerned about the coddled egg in a Caesar dressing. Fortunate enough to live somewhere where I get very fresh eggs from a farm. I don't worry too much about that myself, but I know some people are very concerned with salmonella, and I know that that's a big issue if you're using, you know, standard big factory grocery store eggs.
Well, now, this, of course, can be ordered, right? This book can be ordered right off of our website. We have it listed under OTM Books.
OTM Bookshelf, yes.
Yeah. And do you have a website as well, Karen?
I do. You can visit jamitpickleitcurate.com, and that's all about the book. If you'd like to learn more about me, I'm ksolomon.com, K-S-O-L-O-M-O-N.
Yeah, and I wanted to actually mention that before we concluded this, is that you've done so many interesting things. You classify yourself as a food and lifestyle writer and veteran culinary tinkerer and food crafter. I love that, food crafter, too.
Well, thank you.
Yes, and you have some regular gigs with the San Francisco Chronicle and so forth?
Right. I've been a freelance writer for about 14 years.
Yes, and the City Magazine, too. Yeah, I did that for a while. Anything else that we should know about this?
I think it's a fantastic book, especially for beginners, for people who are new to food crafting in their own kitchen. And I just wish that everybody ate well and cooked well. Good luck to your audience, and good luck to you guys.
Yeah, well, we're looking forward to trying out some of these things.
Okay.
I should try this. Everybody's making homemade marshmallows now, and I've never liked marshmallows, but I used to think they grew on bushes.
that's as good a way as I can think of to end the program. Karen, thank you so much for joining us on the menu.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Keep in touch, Karen. We'll email you.
Great. Fantastic. Please.
Thanks. Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Well, you know what you need to do now, but right now, actually, it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are again, and I have a question for you, Rabideau.
You do?
Yeah. What else is it you do in the summertime?
I cook out all the time.
Yeah. And next up, we have two great books to bring everybody up to speed on what you need to know to do really great grill meals in the summer. Or anytime. We actually grill in the snow sometimes.
I grill in the snow sometimes.
Yeah, that's true. These are
really excellent books. Very, very knowledgeable authors with a new contribution to make to the world of outdoor cooking that I know you'll all appreciate. First up, we have
300.
We have Judith Fertig with 300 Big and Bold Recipes, which she points out were born in the kitchen and then adapted to the grill, which is an extremely interesting way of going about it, and then Soaked and Slathered by Elizabeth Carmel, absolutely the last word to say on how you should treat the stuff you're going to put on the grill before you put it there.
Well, this is the Dining Diva talking to one of the two barbecue queens, Judith Fertig. Welcome to On the Menu, Judith.
Oh, thank you very much.
And the other barbecue queen is your co-author, Karen Adler. But we're going to be talking to you about your book today, which is 300 Big and Bold Barbecue and Grilling Recipe. Now, I guess I'm going to have to ask, of course we're in the right season, but what distinguishes your book from all the gazillion other barbecue books we get?
It's like every year there are quite a few barbecue books out for barbecue season, but what is different about ours is that we encourage you to try something new. Try a new ingredient, try a new technique, because barbecue and grilling is done the world over. And our book, 300 Big and Bold Barbecue and Grilling Recipes, brings that world pantry to your kitchen. Now, you can, of course, use all kinds of local ingredients, but we urge you to try something a little new. If you haven't tried, for example, wrapping pork in a banana leaf and doing that on the grill. Banana leaves, which are frozen, are more available than ever before. Try some kind of a condiment that maybe you haven't tried before. Maybe it's a smoked salt, or perhaps it's a different kind of an Asian sauce. So there are all kinds of things that you can do to tantalize your taste buds and get a really big and bold flavor in a very easy way.
Yeah, this was reading. You were special in this bold flavor.
I think the other thing that's interesting is the range of ingredients that you have. We have, is it Steve Reichlin, who thinks he's the barbecue king of the whole universe?
Yes.
And we get his book, and it's got...
We did another one called Barbecue or Grilling Around the World.
Yeah,
we did that too.
But some of them are sort of... They're almost how-to books about how to grill and how to smoke and less about the recipes and lots of rubs and mops and sauces and that kind of thing. Whereas it seems to me that you take a much more complete meal approach. Am I on the right track there?
Yes. My co-author Karen Adler and I really started off as cooks first and became barbecuers later. So we look at doing a lot of different things on the grill. You know, a lot of barbecue books specialize in basically meat. But we look at fish and shellfish and chicken and turkey, lamb, fruits and vegetables. We just did this past weekend. We were doing cooking classes in Indiana, and we did grilled bananas that were wonderful. And, you know, it makes a great way to do a very, very easy dessert for the summertime. And it's accompanied by a Puerto Rican buttery rum sauce that takes about 5 minutes to make. So it's, you know, we like things that deliver really big flavor and with very little effort. And that's the kind of thing that goes all the way through our book.
Did we mention you're in Kansas City?
Which is at least one of the homes of barbecue. And you were kind enough to let us know that the legendary Arthur Bryant's is still in business. Is it still in the same place down by the old baseball park?
Yes, still in the same place, and people are still lined up at lunchtime to go in and get one of those gargantuan sliced beef brisket sandwiches that are so good.
And I bet they didn't clean the broiler yet.
No, That's part of the charm.
They always said part of the flavor was the decades of grease that built up
around the... And you used to like those burn bits.
Oh, yeah. Well, you can get all the burn bits you wanted. And they were also huge experts on French fries.
Oh, yeah, that's right. They're very good.
They did absolutely fabulous French fries.
Well, let's get back to this book here. What do you think in this book is something that you could pretty well bet nobody's tried?
Well, grilling bananas, I think that's one.
No, we've never grilled bananas, I know
that.
No, we haven't.
We just did a grilled escargot salad, and this is actually from Persia, from ancient Persia, not ancient. I mean, they weren't grilling escargot back in ancient Persia, but it's basically Persia was where Iran and Iraq are today. And it's very, very easy to grill escargot or romaine if you use kind of the hearts of escargot, hearts of romaine, and cut the whole elongated head in half lengthwise and brush just the cut side with olive oil and grill just the cut side over medium-high to high heat with the lid open, and that way you get a really delicious take on salad because you actually do get grill marks on the lettuce, which is hard to believe.
Well, it's like radicchio, the same thing, right?
Yeah, and you get the crunchiness of the salad, but you get the taste of the grill, which is wonderful.
Now, you put some unconventional cuts that I wouldn't ordinarily grill. I'm looking upside down here, one called tequila chili lamb shanks. Now, I would have thought that as a cut of lamb, the shank is almost the last thing that I put on the grill, but obviously
right.
you're proving me wrong.
Well, you can use the grill. There is direct heat grilling where you put a burger directly over the open flame. But then there's also indirect grilling, and this is the recipe you mentioned, the lamb shanks, is a good example of indirect grilling in which you have the fire on one side and you have the pot with the lamb shanks on the other side. And you cover the, you close the lid on the grill, and basically it acts as an oven. So, but you have far more flavor doing your lamb shanks outside than you would inside.
So you actually put the lamb shanks in a pot.
Yeah, you put it in a pot with the liquid ingredients, the Mexican ingredients, and close the lid of the grill, and it's just wonderful. It gets that wonderful flavor of the grill.
Oh, okay, because when I do indirect cooking, and I cook legs of lamb all the time, it's my definitive barbecue dish, but I have the meat on a rack in the center of the grill, and underneath it a place where all the dripping goes and all the marinade goes.
Yeah.
And I call that indirect cooking, but you're saying it's also valid to actually have a pot inside the grill.
Right. You can, that's another thing that we cover in our book, is that there's so many different ways that you can grill. You can grill with a kiss of smoke, and that means that you use wood chips either over on top of the charcoal or in a metal smoker box placed near a gas jet on a gas grill. And again, you know, if you want to grill with a kiss of smoke, in order to capture the smoke once it starts, you have to close the lid of the grill. You can herb grill something. You can indirect. You can grill roast. You can do all of these different things. And basically, it's just opening the lid or closing the lid, adding something for flavor, putting something directly over the flame or off to the side, all kinds of things that you can really get the most out of your grill.
Now, let's go down a sexist track here for a second, because in my house, the man is master of the grill and the woman is master of the kitchen, and I think that would be an American stereotype. Have you come across any credibility problems, you and your friend, in talking to guys about what's in your book?
No, not really, because guys are always looking for a technique or a new recipe. But we have noticed that when we do classes, there is a difference that women never come up to you and say, I want to tell you about how I do pork tenderloin, or I want to tell you my method for grilling a steak. And it's really kind of fun. The guys have their certain way that they like to do things, whereas women, I think, are more, it's more about getting the meal on the table, not so much having the meat part of it as the focus. So it's just a different approach to a meal, but no, we haven't run into that.
I think I just got stereotyped.
I think
because I do have my way of doing things, and curiously enough, I have students around the city and around the country who, if they get into trouble, call me and say, what do I do next?
Yeah, and, yeah. There's not, we take the fee that there's no one perfect way to do anything. It's how you like it. For example, if you're doing baby back ribs, some people like texture of a baby back rib to be very shreddy. Other people like it to have a little bit of a bite to it. So if you want a shreddy texture, very tender, that the meat kind of shreds when you bite into it, there's one way that you do ribs, and usually you will bake those first and then finish them on the grill. If you like more of a bite to when you bite into the meat, that it's not going to shred off the bone, but it's a little firmer, as and people like ribs that way in Kansas City, then you do them totally on the grill. So it's how you like things. Some people like their steak to have kind of a smoky flavor. Other people like their, let's say, a ribeye to have kind of a charry exterior and to be rare in the center. And then there's a different way that you would get that. So it's whatever you like. We try to tell you in each recipe in our book what the food is going to taste like, what the texture is going to be like, so that you can choose a recipe that's going to have the outcome that you want.
Well, you know, your recipes are really delicious. I mean, I'm looking at all this stuff. Herbs de Provence, wood-grilled rabbit, smoked. We've cooked, actually, a goose on our grill.
Oh, yeah.
That was the big we. It was the most delicious meat that ever came off the grill. But Anne was smart enough to realize there would be a lot of fat. So she used our friend's Oriental steamer to take off half the fat. Otherwise, she was concerned otherwise that it might be an incendiary mess.
Yeah, well, see, that's the way, you know, that's the way that these techniques get born, is that you think, okay, this is what I have. Now, what am I going to do to, you wanted a finish that wasn't going to be fatty. And yeah. So you figured it out.
I didn't want a fire.
The interesting thing is, you know the apocryphal story about how barbecuing got started?
Oh, yeah.
It happened in ancient China. The man had a pig, and his house burned down, but the pig was wonderful. I think what you've done, and I want to emphasize this, before we let you go, I want to emphasize this, because I think what you've done in presenting this book is you presented three wonderful, what I call crossovers, chasms that the regular griller won't ever cross. Unless encouraged. One is to go from burgers and chops and steaks to fish, where a much more delicate hand is required. And I remember my legs practically wobbled the first time I put $28 a pound halibut and $30 a pound Copper River salmon on the grill, because I thought, my God, if I make a mess of this, just think of all the money I wasted. But you've done two other things as well that I think I want to highlight, although they did come up in the conversation. One is to go towards vegetables, and not just the traditional grilling vegetables, but things like lettuce and escarole, which would be viewed as rather delicate, I think, by most people. And then the other is to go to desserts, which I've never done. So this is a wonderful collection of 300 books. The only reason I'm getting a word in edgeways here in the interview is because Anne's looking at all the recipes.
I'm having a hard time getting a word in edgeways, period.
Well, we're grilling, but you're not a grill
person. Char-grilled squid and octopus. Yeah, but I mean, I have cooked for many, many years, and these recipes are dynamite. This squid and an octopus thing is wonderful. And I often wonder, here's the answer. I was just envisioning putting a lobster on the grill and how awful that would be. But here you have it. You numb it first in the freezer.
Right. Right, you either,
then,
yeah.
Then you plunge them into boiling water, so they're dead when they go on the grill.
Right, they just need to be finished on the grill. We didn't, you know, and we still have that female sensibility that you don't want to think of anything that is suffering. And so we didn't, even the lobster, we didn't want to, you know, do the lobster live on the grill. That was just a thing.
We're having scallops tonight. Yeah. Which is your favorite scallop recipe here?
I'm not going to do them on the grill. It takes too much time to get the grill going. They only need 5 minutes on our wonderful new stove with the
right.
Super duper hot
burner.
Well,
that's why, and we think like women too, in that if you are going to be, you brought up a good point, Peter, that why turn on the grill to do something that's only going to take 5 minutes? And I agree with you, and that's why I do offer vegetable and dessert recipes, so that you can do more than one thing on the grill when you're out there.
Oh, you even have the scallops a la piastra. I've always wanted to get one of those.
You could just use a regular pancake griddle that you take outside and put over the
We have one
hot
of those
fire.
With our new serve, actually.
Well, Judith, considering that you weren't expecting to talk to us today, this is something for another day. I think you did an absolutely wonderful job.
You asked very, very good questions.
We love your book, and we're not going to part with it. We give quite a number of books away, but this one's a keeper.
This is a keeper.
Oh,
and,
good.
And we thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you
for joining us today.
It's yums, yums, Judy.
Right, take care.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye.
Well, it certainly is the season, and we welcome Elizabeth Carmel to the show. That's her new book, Soaked, Slathered, and Seasoned, A Complete Guide to Flavoring Food for the Grill. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Anne. It's so great to be talking to you today.
Now, you have so many interesting aspects to what you do. Could you tell us a little bit about your background and your TV appearances and your equipment? And just tell us what you do.
Okay, well, I would love to. I grew up in North Carolina, and that's where I initially fell in love with barbecue. But I had to sort of move away from North Carolina to realize how much I appreciated it, which is a very typical sort of human story, isn't it? You never appreciate what you have until you move away from it. And
you had this pulled pork.
What I had was North Carolina-style pulled pork, and that is what started my entire love affair with outdoor cooking, because I realized that if I was going to have it more than once or twice a year when I went home, I was going to have to teach myself how to make it. And I had very little experience with the grill. This was many years ago. And I said, you know what, I'm just going to see what I can do just intuitively. And so I bought the biggest Boston butt I could find, and I put it on the grill over indirect heat, and I let it sit there and cook low and slow for about 8 hours, and I came back and all the exterior fat was crispy and rendered out just like fabulous, fabulous little chips, and it was a mahogany color, and it was so soft. All you had to do to pull it into shreds to make pulled pork was to use two forks that cross each other. And then my next step was to try to make the vinegar dip that is that North Carolina is so famous for.
Yeah, which I love.
I do too, because it doesn't mask the flavor of the meat. It absolutely enhances it and just cuts through the richness of that wonderful smoky pulled pork. And so anyway, that night when I was just experimenting, it was so delicious. Everybody said it was the best pulled pork they'd ever had. And to this day, and I've made it hundreds of times since, if not thousands of times, my recipe is almost exactly like it was that first day, and that's really how easy it is. So if you do something and you like it and everybody else around you likes it, you're buoyed by that success to try something else. And so one by one, I literally tried everything I could think of to cook on the grill, and in fact, my motto is, if you can eat it, you can grill it.
Yeah, here, I'm looking at oysters on a half shell.
I love oysters on the half shell.
And I love smoked oysters. I never thought of doing them myself.
You know what? It's so easy. I mean, that's the thing about outdoor cooking, and that's what I've really tried to do with my website, girlsatthegrill.com, and with all of my cookbooks. I wrote a more general cookbook called Taming the Flame a few years ago. Is I want to show people that, you know, they get this food at a restaurant. Well, you know what? It's so easy to make it at home. And so a lot of what I'm doing is demystifying outdoor cooking, because there is such a sense of accomplishment when you make it yourself. And plus, you get to choose your ingredients. You get to choose exactly how you like it. And it's also fun and relaxing to cook this at home.
Now, we skipped over this equipment.
Yes. Well, along the way.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Along the way. I mean, you have a day job in there too, right?
Yes. Yes. Well, along the way, of course, I got so involved in outdoor cooking, both the authentic Southern barbecue part of it, and then literally translating all my favorite world flavors into how to cook them and use them in foods that I've made from the grill. And I started looking for example, the perfect basting brush, and I couldn't find one. And in restaurants and in backyards everywhere, people look at their ribs or their chicken that have been slathered with a wonderful barbecue sauce, and and they're like, I've got a hair in my food, and they look at that. Well, it's not really the cook's hair. It's really a bristle from the basting brush.
Yeah, they do that, don't they?
They do. And, you know, it's, of course, it's horrifying to the cook, and then you look down, and you're like, oh, that's not my hair. That's the brush's hair. And so anyway, one of my very first products was a basting brush that had a silicone head.
Yeah, I was just going to say, the silicone brushes don't do that, do they?
No, they do not. They're fabulous. Not only that, you put them in the dishwasher,
yeah,
and they are like new every single time. They don't retain the flavors, the smells of aggressive ingredients like a natural bristle brush does. And I made mine with an angle. And the reason I did that is by the time you're putting the barbecue sauce on, and here's a big tip, you only put the barbecue sauce on during the last 10 or 15 minutes of the cooking time. And at that time, the grill is hot, your food's hot, and it's uncomfortable sometimes to contort your wrist. And so now this angled brush keeps your hand away from the fire and the flame, and you can get into all the little crevices on the food very, very simply. And my line of products is called Grill Friends.
Grill Friends.
G-R-I-L-L.
And that's your website, and all these products are listed?
You can get it at grillfriends.com.
Okay.
And my more editorial site is called girlsatthegrill.com.
Right.
There you go. This is a really, listeners, this is a really fundamentally sound book. I mean, that's one of the amazing things about it. Because,
well, thank you.
Because it divides up the different approaches, putting things on the food in a way that I hadn't really thought of before. So you've got section, the soaked section is all about marinades and brines.
Right.
And I'm guessing that they impart flavor, but then you throw them away.
Yes, that's my recommendation.
Then you've got slathered, which is sauces, glazes, and mops. And I never would have even thought of the distinction between the three, but you, of course, explain that and explain the uses of the different things. Then you've got salsas, relishes, and jellies, which are side dishes, I guess, but you make those on the grill, too?
Well, no, these are all sauces that you accent the food with. So at the beginning of my book, I offer what I call Grilling 101, and it is recipes that employ my trademarked grilling trilogy, which is olive oil, salt, and pepper, so that you can make, you know, basically any protein that you can buy at the store and you can think of, because there's been research done that we all eat the same 20 foods over and over and over again.
I bet you we do, too.
And right, and then the fine print on that is that we especially eat five of those foods over and over and over again. And so let's take chicken, for example, because chicken is very popular and very common. If you think about chicken, what gets monotonous about chicken is the way that you cook it, the flavors that you use when you're cooking it, right?
Right.
So with my book, you could cook chicken every single night for a year and not duplicate any of the flavors by using brines and marinades and sauces and glazes and mops. And the sweet relishes, the sauces, the jellies, the way they come in is they become a wonderful flavor accent. For example, hot pepper jelly, which is one of my favorite things and very common in the South, turns into a wonderful glaze, or you just put a dollop of it on, you know, on hot pork tenderloin or chicken, as we were talking about, or many other things. It's great.
You need to have a lot of different ways of using it, though.
Right.
Otherwise, it languishes in your refrigerator.
right, exactly. And so,
you don't need a whole lot of it, yeah.
You don't need a lot of it, but that little bit of flavor can completely change your dish.
Right. Now, you fun names for your various flavorings, too, and sauces.
Well, thank you. You know, I think you have to, there's so many cookbooks out there today, and I think that you really need to engage the reader, or at least I need to be engaged as well. And cooking is fun, and the great thing about outdoor cooking is it's all about community. It's as close to a vacation as you can have without leaving your house. And so why not have some fun with it? The other thing is, there is nothing more fun than the barbecue circuit. And I think one of the reasons that authentic Southern barbecue and the barbecue competitions are growing in popularity is because there's nothing serious about it. Everybody has fun, from young to old. People,
You know, have you ever been to the Big Apple Barbecue?
I have. In fact, my restaurant, Hill Country, participated for the last 3 years.
So have you ever been? We went last year. You were there?
Yeah, yes, I was. I was the lone girl wearing the black cowboy hat and the red cowboy boots.
I don't know.
Who did we interview?
I don't know how we missed you, but we did. We interviewed a guy from Ubon's in Yazoo City.
Gary Roark, and
Gary,
you know,
Roark.
he is one of my favorite barbecue buddies, and his comeback sauce is in my book. His comeback sauce is a very famous regional sort of Alabama, Mississippi sauce. And do you know why it's called the comeback sauce?
Go ahead.
Because you keep coming back for more. That's exactly right. But the interesting thing is in my book, I give the recipe for his sauce. It's on page 312 of the book. And then he also gave me a recipe for the come hither sauce for people who don't like mayonnaise, because the comeback sauce is heavily made up of mayonnaise.
Well, that was a great event, and barbecue conquered New York City. That's for sure. Everybody.
I've never seen so many people turn up at this. Some people would go for 2 days, and it wasn't cheap, especially in the VIP section.
No, you could buy a VIP ticket for 2 days and totally OD.
Every single one of them.
OD on barbecue, but you can now totally OD on barbecue all on your own, because all the secrets and all the tools and all the do's and don'ts are in this really excellent book.
It is Gerber, yeah.
And let's go over what it's called again. It's called
Folks Slathered in Season.
There it is, Elizabeth Carmel. And, this is fun, and you're fun.
Thank you. I love it. You know what? I'm so lucky I get to grill for a living. I mean, can you imagine anything more fun to do day in and day out?
Are you in Chicago?
I am. I live between, actually, Chicago and New York.
And you go out in this knee-deep snow.
I do. I've got a whole wardrobe of fabulous coats. And, you know, in fact, my dirty little secret is that I grill more in the wintertime than the summertime, because as a good Southern girl, I just crave a tomato sandwich in the summer. But in the wintertime, I want, you know, grilled meat.
You're fun.
You must have some really smelly clothes.
No. Eau de smoke. It actually smells great.
There you go. Well, thank you.
It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much. It was a whole lot of fun.
Yes.
And keep up the great work with all these new tools, because we always need new ideas all the time about how to make the process of barbecuing better.
Well, thank you so much, and I really had fun talking to y'all today.
Okay, thanks, Elizabeth.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye.
Well, that just about does it for another program, don't you think?
It does it for another program that I was planning to make, but you never can tell. You never can tell just exactly what's going to happen on this dynamic program. But, of course, the one thing we do know is we'll see you again same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.